You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Battle for the Island Kingdom. England's destiny, 1000 to 1066. Is a rich history of the years leading up to 1066 when Vikings, Anglo-Saxons and Normans vied for the English crown. It's a tale of loyalty, treason and military might that will put Game of Thrones to shame. It is a new book by Don Holloway. Delighted to say that Don joins us live on the line from somewhere an awful long way from Hastings, I'd imagine. Where are you, Don?
I'm in central Pennsylvania, USA.
Very nice part of the world, rich in history itself, but a couple of years later than that. What's led you to delve then into a fascinating period of English history? 1066 is obviously every English schoolboy, every British schoolboy will know that date, but we know, I suppose, very little about the tumultuous events that lead up to that climactic battle.
Well, 1066 is what got me started on it. I was an American schoolboy, not a British schoolboy, but that year fascinated me as well. Actually, my first magazine article that I ever wrote back in 1994 was on the Battle of Hastings, and I never fell out of love with that period. But at the same time, I did not know a lot of the events leading up to it. I mean, I knew 1066 as being the year of the three battles with the Viking invasion and the Norman conquest, but I didn't really know what had happened before that. And when the opportunity came through my publisher, I pitched the idea to them that I'd like to write the lead up to that battle. And they said, go for it. Vikings are hot right now with the TV shows, you know, Vikings, Valhalla and everything. And this book is actually sort of the realist version of Vikings, Valhalla. That TV show takes a bunch of the same characters, but just sort of throws them together and makes a story out of them, where if you want to get the true story, it's in my book.
And as always, the true history is even more entertaining, more devious, and more conniving and more bloody than anything that the scriptwriters can come up with.
I think so. As I say, they take a lot of the historical characters and the historical events, but they just sort of mix them together. When I first saw Harald Hardrada in like the first 5 minutes of the show, which takes place in about 1002, and he's already middle-aged. Well, he wasn't even born until 1015. And I think I'm out at this point. And I realize it's entertainment. It's not a documentary, but, it does not run. Does not run well with the history that I know.
So let's set the scene. What are we calling it? We're calling it 1000. We're calling it 1001 or whatever.
We've got three.
The Anglo-Saxons. So we're talking about sort of basically England. Is it still? Have we now managed to? Are we now basically England? We're not Mercia anymore. We're not the separate kingdoms. But it's sort of Anglo-Saxon England. But there are still very powerful families within it.
Right. It is Anglo-Saxon England at this point. Mercia is still there. Wessex is still there. Northumbria is still there, but they are all earldoms. They used to be separate kingdoms, but they have been united now, and it's one Anglo-Saxon kingdom. At the time that the book starts, around the year 1000, the king is Ethelred II. He's pretty famously called Ethelred the Unready, although that's not literally a translation of his nickname, and I am willing to bet nobody called him that to his face while he was still alive. But he was the king of the Anglo-Saxons at this point. The Vikings had more or less been, for a couple hundred years, they had ruled the Danelaw, basically Northumbria, the northern half of the kingdom, but they had been more or less pushed out. And the whole thing really kicks off with Ethelred taking the Vikings, who are still living in England, who have, you know, married English girls and they're living in England. He orchestrates a massacre of them in 1002, and that's really what kicks the whole thing off.
And are we talking about, because Vikings get misunderstood very, I mean, I'm not saying go and hug your local Viking, but what I mean by that is the fact that they are often portrayed as these wild men or women, going all the way back to sort of Kirk Douglas running along the oars through to the recent...
I love that movie!
Oh, yeah, everybody loves that movie. And that perhaps in a way is perhaps more realistic than some other bits and pieces that we have seen recently. But in terms of as a society and in terms of exploration, I mean, Vikings things were got everywhere, and I mean in a good way. But their structure, they weren't your normal sort of feudal or early Middle Ages structure. And that makes them sort of difficult to pin down. So were the Vikings at this point in an ascendancy? I mean, they're still around for another couple of hundred, you know, as an organization or as a body, and for at least another 200 years.
Well, they've been around. I think it was off the top of my head, it was the 780s when they first appeared in England and they raided Lindisfarne, yeah. The monastery up in Northumbria. So they had been around for, 250 years at this point. But really, this is really the peak of their, or just about to become the peak of their activity as time goes on, and you find Canute the Great comes in and becomes king of England by force. He also makes himself king of Denmark and king of Norway and forms what's called the North Sea Empire. And that's really the pinnacle of Viking society when he basically rules, the meat of Northwest Europe up there and has a Norman queen. So he has an attachment to that side of the channel as well. That's really the pinnacle of Viking society. Now, after Canute's death, things start to go downhill pretty quick. His empire breaks up. Norway and Denmark go to war for 15, 16 years. And that's really where things start to go downhill. 1066 is usually marked as the end of the Viking Age. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are still Scandinavians up there, but they're not in the raiding business so much anymore.
But and also we have, excuse me, sort of roaring up from the south, as it were, Normans. Now, again, most English, especially at my time, think, okay, well, they're the French, but my goodness, they weren't, were they?
I'm not going there. No, the Normans had, they were descendants of Vikings. They had moved in, actually started as raiders down in the French coast, literally the Normandy beaches where the Normandy invasion was in 1944. They had sort of set up shop there and sort of colonized it, and it got to the point where the French king at that time decided it would be easier to have these guys on my side and have them fight any other Vikings who want to land in Normandy. And that's basically what he did. He took Rollo, who was a character in the original Viking show, and actually his name was Rolf, but they changed it, Frenchified it and made it Rollo, and made him a Duke of Normandy. And that became his little fiefdom over there, and that's where their setup started.
And I mean, the Normans is pretty much, and shoot me down in flames if I'm wrong here, Don, but they're a pretty martial society. I mean, the Viking society again is very much the beautiful arts and crafts of Viking society, and the same with Anglo-Saxon. But I've always thought the Normans as a pretty, because they were massively successful expanding their empire. You know, they end up in Sicily, for goodness sake. They come across as a pretty martial sort of outfit.
Yeah, they did not lose their Viking outlook on violence, that's for sure. They were not the seamen that the Vikings were. They had the problems with crossing the channel. They tried an invasion actually in like the 1030s and failed miserably because they got blown off course. So they weren't the sea rovers that the Vikings were. But yes, they were fighting men. I mean, they were, if you imagine, they were a pack of wolves, and whoever was the top wolf in the pack was the one who became the duke. I mean, you had to grab this territory by the scruff of the neck and hold it and keep it that way.
Now, we tend to think of this whole situation as sort of men putting axes, you know, cleaving other people's heads off with axes, arrows, you name it. But there is, as in, you know, I loved Game of Thrones, but we shouldn't go back to Game of Thrones as a reference point for everything that happens in this period. But there are some incredibly strong women in this, and with the menfolk getting slaughtered on a regularly relative basis or away for long periods of time, because it's not a question, is, you know, if you are going to subdue an enemy on a coast 900 miles away, that's going to take you some time by foot, because horses are rare as well. So the women have got an awful lot of things, and they don't just sit around doing needlepoint at home, do they?
No, they do not. One of the central characters in the whole story is Emma of Normandy, who was a daughter of the Duke of Normandy, and she became betrothed to Ethelred, who we mentioned before, and became Queen of England. They did not have a particularly happy marriage, but she did bear him children and, you know, did her royal duty in that sense. And when Canute the Great came over and ended up fighting and, you know, basically took over England and Ethelred died, Canute turned around and married her because it was not uncommon to take a dead foe's wife as a kind of trophy. I mean, that's what it amounted to. And for her part, she's decided, well, I've been Queen of England for 15 years. Here's the next king. I can either go into exile as a, you know, sort of dowager or something like that, or I can marry this guy and continue to be Queen of England. And that's what she did. At some cost to her own family, she left her sons by Ethelred, left them in Normandy. And I think when they grew up, they pretty much resented her for that fact. They did not really get along with her.
And so, you've got this situation is highly volatile, and it's enough having sort of bloodline and invading Vikings and one, you know, Vikings to the northeast and Normans sort of gnashing their teeth at you from the south coast. But you've also got kingmakers, and I know we all say the power behind the throne, but here we have, ladies and gentlemen, from behind the arras, coming weighing in at 115 pounds, Godwin of Wessex. Tell us about him.
Well, he's another central character in the thing. He is basically a boy, and he's an Anglo-Saxon, fights for the English, but soon goes over to the Viking side. There's nothing really for him. His father was declared an outlaw, and Godwin was sort of looked down on for that fact, and he ended up joining the Vikings and actually rose through the ranks and became Canute the Great's one of his second in commands. And when Canute passed away, there was a couple other, his sons came down, Harald Harefoot and Hartha Canute, they came over, and Godwin managed to play the game and stay on top with all these successive kings. I mean, served Canute, served Harald Harefoot, served Hartha Canute, and then served Edward the Confessor, who was Emma's boy from France. When all the other kings die, he's the last man standing. Edward, he comes over, and Godwin manages to make himself second in command there. So he is really the consistent power behind the throne through this whole story.
So are we looking at an early Middle Ages version of Henry Kissinger then, basically? Is that a pretty good way of putting him?
Something like that. I probably would not have reached for that analogy, well, but I'll go along with it.
Are we looking at sort of, because there's all this sort of intestine fighting, and there's all this warfare. But we don't really get it. Do we get any big pitched battles at this time, or is it until 66 when it just breaks loose like a tidal wave for Harald?
No. When before Canute became king, there was Vikings and Anglo Saxons fighting up and down and up and down and back and forth across England. You had Canute's father, Svein Forkbeard, who took offense at that massacre that I had mentioned back in 1002 when Ethelred had the Danes in England killed. Svein took that as a personal insult because his sister was one of the ones that were killed, and he made it his life's work to make Ethelred and Emma as miserable as he possibly could.
Can we just jump back then onto that one? Because, again, a lot of people won't know this. I mean, when you say the massacre of all the Danes in England, that is horrendous and ghastly, and this obviously sets the, you know, this is the thing that lights the spark that will come to sort of flaming retribution sort of 64 right. years later. Is it sort of just some mad killing spree, or is this preordained? And I mean, what are we talking about in numbers here? I mean, this wasn't just one night, presumably. This was over a couple of months or something.
I don't think there's any specific numbers written down, but it's not a fictitious event. They have found the grave sites, mass graves, at several places in England, and they carbon date them to this, the skulls to this, you know, or the bones, I should say, to this period. And these guys were just viciously murdered. I mean, decapitated, And some of them were found with their heads placed between their legs. And some of them were burned because they herded some of the Danes into a church and burned the church down around them. So it was a genocide. There's no numbers, but if you read the accounts, it's pretty horrific. I mean, it was a race war. That's what it amounted to.
Again, it's interesting because it's history. You know, I mean, without saying facile, hit there, we only sort of know. We will only ever know the high bits of history until we actually sort of dig much deeper. And again, that's not a part of archaeology, but certain things can completely sort of pass you by. Let's cut to sort of the run in then to the date that I mentioned at the top of the interview, which is, you know, every schoolboy knows. There is, it's, and again, if you just look at the Bayeux tapestry, it's, you know, Harold copping one in the eye with an arrow, debatable. But there is, again, there is cross, double cross, and brother against brother, literally.
Right. Yeah. So the story of 1066 actually starts in the very first week when King Edward the Confessor dies, and he is the one who really triggered the whole thing. He was half Norman on his mother's side, Emma of Normandy, as we already mentioned. He had a problem with Godwin and the sons of Godwin. They held all the power in England. Edward was basically just a figurehead. At one point, the Godwins actually rebelled, and he managed to unite the other territories, Mercia and Northumbria, against them and exiled them for about a year. And while they were gone, he called his kinsman, his cousin, William of Normandy, the Duke of Normandy, over to England and supposedly promised him the kingdom because Edward was childless. He was married to Godwin's daughter, and they had no children, whether out of hatred for her family or one of them was infertile, nobody knows. But there was no obvious heir to the king now that the Godwins were gone. So Edward promises the kingdom to Duke William, if you believe the Norman accounts. Now, in about a year, the Godwins return and they take back the kingdom and basically force Edward, you know, to acknowledge their power. All the Normans in England are gone. Godwin's back in power, and his son Harold now becomes the most likely heir. When Godwin dies soon after that, around New Year's on 1066, Edward's on his deathbed. And to believe the Anglo-Saxon accounts, he reneges on his promise that he made to William and promises the kingdom to Harold. Now, here's the extra fold on this. The year before, Harold had been in Normandy. Whether he was shipwrecked there or went there on a diplomatic mission, he was in Normandy, and Duke William forced a promise out of him that if Harold, who was the logical heir at this point, ever became king, that he would give the power, he would give the kingdom over to William. So you've got all these promises that these guys are making with no intention of ever holding themselves to it. And that's where the whole problem arises. When Edward dies, Harold takes the kingdom. Duke William says to him, "Wait a minute, this is supposed to be my kingdom. What are you doing?" And Harold says, "Well, I'm on the throne now. If you want it, come take it." Mm. And that's basically how it starts.
And if that wasn't enough, you know, coming in from the northeast, Harald Hardrada decides, you know, the Viking king decides this is the opportune time to have a crack, basically.
Right. You had mentioned brother against brother. Yeah. Harald has a brother named Tostig, who had been the Earl of Northumbria and turned out to be terrible at his job, to the point that Northumbria rebelled. And Harold, at this point, being the the power behind the throne, it's his job to go up and solve this issue. He doesn't want to have a civil war in England. So he goes up and talks to the Northumbrians, and they're saying, "Tostig is a terrible earl. We want him out. We'll put our own man on the throne. You need to agree to this or it's war." And Harold takes a look at the evidence and says, "Wow, Tostig really is a terrible earl. You're right. I'll banish him for the sake of peace. I'll banish him, and he can go find his own way."
Pretty now, ruthless, Tostig, that is. That's pretty ruthless stuff, Don, isn't it?
Well, you know, these guys were playing the game for keeps. I mean, this was literally life and death. I mean, the civil war was threatening, and these guys would be the ones who were putting their lives on the line. These guys did not lead from the rear. When it came time for a battle, they would be right up front swinging a sword with everybody else. So Tostig naturally objects to this whole thing where his brother banished him. He actually goes across to William of Normandy and says, "Hey, I'm going to go back and take this kingdom. Will you help me?" And William says, "Well, I've already had one son of Godwin reneged on his promise. I don't need to have another one. So Tostig goes north to Norway, where King Harald Hardrada, the hard ruler, he's been fighting this war with Denmark for 15 years and has gotten nowhere. And he's thinking he lets Tostig talk him into invading England instead, the other third of Canute's old North Sea Empire. Boy, I'm giving away. This is like a spoiler alert.
I know. Okay, let's kind of leave it there then, so that people go off and buy the book. But I've always felt for Harald, because he and his army just do the grand tour of England, don't they? And you just think, blimey, and it's interesting because, as I said before, history is written by the winners, and everything that then comes, because spoiler alert, William the Conqueror doesn't get his name for nothing. It totally changes the destiny of pretty much Europe during that time.
It absolutely does. I mean, the Battle of Hastings changed everything in England. We speak English the way we speak English because of the Battle of Hastings. Old English was the language that they spoke before the Normans arrived. The Normans kind of brought in their version of French. The aristocracy in England for hundreds of years after that spoke French. The English spoke Old English, but gradually the two languages came together. I've always heard it described as English is a German language with French words in it, and I think that's pretty much the way it happened.
And I can hear Englishmen listening to this shuddering all the way through just on that description. What do you hope that people take from this? Is it to look beyond the stereotypes, dig a little deeper? Because, as I said before, we don't really know that backstory, what leads up to it. We just think, okay, William arrives, there's a big dust up, and the rest, as they say, is history. But is it to actually shine a light on the beginning of that whole last millennium, basically?
Right. I think what you said earlier about Harald, King Harald of England, getting bad press, that's very true, because most of the stuff that was written about him was written by the winners, was written by the Normans. Whereas for the 10 months that he reigned, he was actually a very effective king and well-liked, and took his army on a forced march 200 miles north to York in basically a week, fought a battle, lost most of his men, and then marched them back down to face William. I mean, you have only a great king could have pulled that off. To me, it's one of the great feats in medieval military history.
Yeah, absolutely. The book is called Battle for the Island Kingdom, England's Destiny, 1000 to 1066. It's by Don Holway, who's speaking to you today. Don, if people want to find you online, is there a website? Do you do the social media? Please tell me that you TikTok the Battle of Hastings. That'd be quite something.
I do not TikTok. I'm on Facebook, but I have my own website at Don Holway. It's not Hollow Way, it's Hallway, donhollway.com. But if you want to check out the book, there are free chapters and links to buy at b4tik.com. Battle for the Island Kingdom, b4ik.com.
The book is called Battle
for TIK.
You'll be able to tell. We also have a link on our virtual bookstore, Don, so people can just go on after the interview and click away and find out more. It's been brilliantly written. Don, it's been an absolute pleasure. The back of this book is called Battle for the Island Kingdom. It's by Don Holway. Don, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.